Saturday starts now here on TSN 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg. We are the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website, which has an absolute ton of alumni game and winter classic content, is illegalcurve.com. In case you've missed anything over the past 3 or 4 days as we get geared up for today and tomorrow, check out illegalcurve.com. There's an absolute ton of content. Props to Dave Minuk on my left for putting that all together. Gentlemen, I say good morning to you both. It is finally here. We've been talking about it for a number of weeks, a number of months. The Alumni Game weekend, the Heritage Classic weekend, is now. It starts this afternoon with the Alumni Game, a game you can, of course, hear on TSN 1290. And then tomorrow, the Jets and the Oilers do battle in the regular season contest. We're going to talk tons about the alumni, tons about the history of hockey in Winnipeg. Of course, we'll spend a lot of time focusing on the Jets and the here and the now, because these regular season games do matter for something. But just a quick word, Ezzy, to start the show on, you know, your excitement level for this weekend.
Oh, yeah, it's unparalleled, Drew, and it's unbelievable, guys. There are so many events going on around the city. There was the Jets gala dinner, and there was an event at the Pint, and you had the Jets Hall of Fame luncheon at the Fairmont. There are so many events that you actually forget that there's a game being played this afternoon, right? So, I mean, it's unbelievable, Drew, what has been happening in the city the last 2 or 3 days, you know, with Temu coming into town yesterday, getting the key to the city from Mayor Brian Bowman, and there was a private event yesterday for Temu, and I mean it's just incredible. And you know, there's an actual hockey game to be played on Sunday that matters in the win column, but really it's just been such a great celebration of hockey, the history of the Jets and the Oilers. So I mean, I'm super pumped up. I think we all are for the game this afternoon between the Jets and Oilers alumni, and then the actual game between the Jets and Oilers tomorrow. So it's just been fantastic to see all the fans from Winnipeg celebrating, and then all the fans from out of town that have come in for the game. So, you know, it's a pretty incredible weekend here.
You know, anytime there's a celebration of anything in Winnipeg, I think Winnipeggers know how to do things properly, and they always embrace, you know, whenever we have these big national events to showcase our city. I think we always do a really, you know, banner job in kind of embracing them. And I'm with Ez. I think it looks great, just, you know, how excited everybody is around the city. And, you know, I've been talking to fans who are not even going to the games, just about their excitement and whatnot, about, you know, what they're seeing in the city. And everybody's of the same opinion. Most people are, that I've talked to at least, have said how happy they are for all the events that are going on, like Ez was talking about, and just the general kind of environment that's you know, Winnipeg is right now. And so it's a lot of fun to be going into this weekend, and you know, like you said, it's going to all the different things, and you know, you what's that called at the beside the stadium,
the Spectator Plaza.
Spectator Plaza is, yeah. You know, I drove by there yesterday when we went to the media skate, and it looks awesome. Like, it looks like there's a ton of fan engagement at the U of M, and just the banner and the signage all around the city, and everybody's just so excited and happy of, you know, to show Winnipeg off.
It's, you know, to your point, it's not often that our little burg is in the sort of the public spotlight, or in the national spotlight, or to some extent even the international spotlight, although I don't really believe there's a ton of that for this contest. So when people can look at Winnipeg and they can say, hey, you know, we always want to put our best foot forward, to your point, and make it look like a nice shiny jewel, and sort of let our little secret know about how good the city is, let people outside of Winnipeg sort of embrace that or learn about that, because they might not always know about it. They hear Winnipeg and they hear mosquitoes and they hear flooding and they hear cold, and that's really so little about what we are all about.
Well, it's funny because I was listening to some of the national guys talk, and they're like, yeah, you know, it's, you know, going to be about 40 degrees and stuff. And I'm like, well, guys, it's October. It's not like, it's not December, January, February. We expect it to be minus 20 in October. I mean, it's relatively, you know, decent usually, yeah, in October. So expectation. And I mean, I was looking at the temperatures, and it looks like it's going to be about, you know, 8 or 9 degrees Celsius for the two games. So, I mean, you know, we're not exactly.
Not frigid. It's really, yeah, not Antarctic here, where it never gets above,
that's,
you know,
right,
where it's always 50 below,
I
or
mean,
anything.
I, you know, the irony is that Edmonton, Calgary, and Saskatoon have already had tons of snow.
That's
not
right.
Winnipeg.
No, the snow stops at the Saskatchewan-Manitoba border. They know where it's not allowed to tread any further east, as the case may be in this instance. Anyways, we'll talk a lot more about the alumni game as we do throughout the course of the program. But we start with the Winnipeg Jets and the week that was for the Winnipeg Jets. Going back to last Saturday when the Jets played their first road game of the season, they went into Minnesota and lost a 4-3 game last Saturday in Minnesota. They came home on Monday to face the Boston Bruins, and the Bruins, you know, after an initial push by the Jets, the Bruins easily handled the Jets by a 4-1 margin. And then I think we'll start with Wednesday's game against the Toronto Maple Leafs, because usually you give your opposition a 4-goal lead. It's not something you typically come back from, but the Leafs had that 4-goal lead, the 4-0 lead. Not a good vibe around the MTS Center and around the Winnipeg Jets. But lo and behold, behind the strength of 3 Patrick Laine goals, and we'll talk much more about Patrick Laine, 3 Patrick Laine goals, the Jets end up coming back to win 5-4 in overtime. Both of the Jets' wins this year, now 2-2 on the season, have come by a 5-4 margin in overtime when the Jets have staged some quote-unquote epic comebacks. So let's start with Wednesday. Let's look at the whole week in general. What are you seeing from the Winnipeg Jets so far through 4 games this season, Ez?
Well, you know, Drew, you mentioned the Patrick Laine hat trick, and as far as the Wednesday game goes, all that anyone is going to remember is the Patrick Laine hat trick and the fact that the Jets beat the Leafs in overtime. But as far as I'm concerned, when you're looking at the last 3 games, you know, the first game against the Carolina Hurricanes wasn't a beauty either, but they ended up getting the win in overtime as well.
Sure.
But when you look at the last 3 games, especially the Minnesota game, the Jets were the better team in the first period, but they were awful in the second and third periods. They had a little flurry there in the third period at the end. But when you're talking about those 3 games as a whole, 9 periods, or I guess if you want to include the overtime, 10 periods, I would say that the Jets maybe had 2 good periods. So at the end of the day, the Jets are 2-2, and you know, Patrick Laine's got 4 goals after 4 games. But if you're Paul Maurice and the coaching staff, you're a little bit concerned about the way the Jets have played. I don't think the goaltending has been particularly good. And I'm not saying that Michael Hutchinson and Connor Hellebuck have been awful. Certainly their last 2 games have been better than the first 2. They've each played 1, two. But are you talking about the way the Jets have played in their own zone? I think there's a lot of cause for concern. And again, I don't mean to be, you know, negative Nelly here, but when you're looking at...
No, you mean to be Debbie Downer, though.
Debbie Downer, sure.
Debbie Downer, negative Nelly. I'm trying to think of the other negative team names we can go with here.
2's enough.
2's enough? Okay.
So, you know, you got to be concerned with the way you've played in your own zone and the fact that you've given up so many goals. The Jets aren't having any problem scoring goals. But, you know, I've been impressed by the way – I've been impressed by individual performances, Drew, but I think there's a lot of cause for concern when you're talking about the way the Jets have played in their own zone. I think that Josh Morrissey has been strong. I think that Dustin Byfuglien has struggled at times. I think Tobias Enstrom has struggled at times. And when you're talking about – still, we don't know what's going to happen with Jacob Trouba. I think that's a big cause for concern.
I think there's an interesting number that kind of jumps out at me, is that in all 4 games – the Jets have given up 4 straight goals to their opposition. So that's not a good thing. You know, whether they scored first or they've had to come back and score 5 straight like they did against the Leafs. I mean, it's never a good thing when you're, you know, the game is tight like it was against Boston. And they were in the game. You know, Tuukka Rask had a very nice game for the Bruins. The Jets were probably the better team for the first period at least, but they couldn't solve Rask. But in all 4 games, they've given up 4 goals. And the 2 games... the 2 teams they've beaten are Carolina and Toronto, and we're not exactly talking about like top teams in the East. So, you know, I mean, those are the expectation was at least coming into the season was that these were teams that you should beat. Now, having said that, for the first 4 games, I don't really recognize this team. This is a much like the composition of this team, and obviously it's through the inclusion of all these rookies. It's very different. And there's a lot of words they've been using, you know, around the team, a lot of buzzwords, but chaos has been one of them. And there seems to be a certain amount of chaos with this team, and you really don't know who they are. That identity is still being formed because, like I said, on any given night when I'm watching these guys, you're thinking, who is this team? I don't recognize them from the teams I've seen, these Jets teams that I've seen in the past.
And, you know, you're not wrong about that, but that's certainly a function of they have way more offensive talent than they've had in previous years. But their defensive shortcomings shouldn't come as a surprise to... I mean, we were talking that this Jets team wouldn't be that great defensively, even when they had Jacob Trouba, thought that Jacob Trouba would be in their lineup. I mean, there's no surprise, you know, that they really can't defend from my perspective. But to your point, I mean, if you've given up four consecutive goals in each of your four games, and you're absolutely right that the Jets have done that, well, that's not a recipe for success. I know you're 2-2, and you're okay with that through four games, but, I mean, if that doesn't change, I mean, you know, your goals against on a game-per-game basis is 4.00, you're not going to win consistently in the NHL, giving up four goals a game, no matter how much offense, you know, increases in the course of the NHL season. You know, it's just not a recipe for success to give up four goals a game. And I would imagine what Paul Maurice is preaching. He looks at his defense and he says to, and his defense, you know, just his defensive pairings aren't good enough defensively. So I think to probably remedy that problem, he has to look at a five-man unit playing better defensively than just the back end of his players.
Well, the Jets are still trying to find their identity, guys. I think that's pretty obvious here. And, you know, they're the three rookies that have come into the lineup this year. There's certainly lots of talent. But I think they have to find what the right style is for them to play. And what I mean by that is they obviously want to play a puck possession game, and they want to be a fast team that can score, you know, off the rush and everything like that. But, you know, you look at the way that they've played, and, you know, Dave mentioned it, they haven't exactly played the cream of the crop in the NHL. I mean, you're talking about four pretty easy games to start the season, right? And that's no offense to any of the teams that they've played. Maybe Minnesota is the best out of the four, or you can maybe argue that Boston was the best out of four. But, you know, getting back to these last three games, I actually thought that the best game that the Jets have played this year was against Boston, and they lost that game 4-1. I thought that was one of those games, and you remember, I think they had seven power plays in that game, and they didn't score on any of their opportunities.
And we'll talk more about the power play struggles a little bit later on in the program, but keep going, as
well, and this is something that's been a problem for the Jets for, I would say, four of the five seasons that they've been here. And I mean, I guess you include this year, but this year is only four games old. But, you know, the game against the Bruins, I thought that the Jets controlled the play for the majority of the game. I would say probably two-thirds of that game, the Jets were the better team. And then the Bruins obviously benefited from some timely goals. And Tuukka Rask stole that game, guys.
Sure.
Let's be honest. Tuukka Rask was the Tuukka Rask of old. So I thought the Jets' best game was that third game of the year. But certainly, guys, I mean, I disagree with you a little bit, Drew. I think if Jacob Trouba is in this lineup, I think that the Jets' defense is significantly better. And you could say that about many teams.
I think it's significantly better, but I don't think anybody ever thought that they were going to be a juggernaut defensive team, even with Jacob Trouba in their lineup. But I mean,
maybe not a juggernaut, but I definitely think the Jets would be, let's say, one of the better teams defensively, top 15, I would say. I don't know if I would say they're a top 10 defensive team, because you also have to include how well does Josh Morrissey develop in his rookie year, right?
Sure.
So needless to say, I mean, the Jets have struggled in their own zone, and that's something that they're going to have to work on. They've got to be better. Like, when you look at, you got the Dallas Stars coming up twice next week.
Mm-hmm.
Dallas Stars have the best offense of the league, right, guys? So, I mean, if you're giving up four goals a game, and you haven't even played some of the best teams in the league, the Dallases, the Washingtons, teams like that,
yeah.
I mean, you're going to run into some problems.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The Jets, I mean, Paul Maurice knows it, that the Jets are going to need to have to shore up on their defensive shortcomings. The offense has been there, but the defense has been a little bit lacking. Let's go to break. When we come back, we talk more about Patrick Laine. He's got the four goals in the four games. What are reasonable expectations for the Jets rookie for the remainder of the season? You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Bufflin shot, Laine scores! Bufflin with the shot, the rebound onto the stick of Patrick Laine, kept in at the line for Laine, scores! Patrick Laine from Nikolai Ehlers, 4-4! Here comes Laine, two in the game, looking for three, scores! 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 Patrick Laine, his first NHL two-goal game, his first NHL hat-trick, and it's an overtime winner for the Winnipeg Jets as they come back from 4-1 in the third period and beat the Toronto Maple Leafs 5-4.
Dennis Bayak with the call on Patrick Laine's three-goal game Wednesday night against the Maple Leafs. Dennis in fine form with that call, certainly. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich, located in the Cordon Village Mall. Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com. And of course, if you're looking for a place to watch either of the two games this weekend and all NHL hockey games, Bernstein's Deli has got you set up. They got the big screens. They got the audio pumping over the loudspeakers. And they got great drink and food specials. Check them out, bernsteinsdeli.com.
So, Drew, I made a bit of a mistake this past Thursday evening.
I don't believe you would have ever made a mistake, Ezzy. I can't believe this. You have blown me away to begin with.
Yeah, I usually am Mr. Perfect.
Mr. Perfect.
Right.
Like the wrestler?
Yes.
So we have a ball hockey league that we have going on Thursday nights at a local gymnasium, elementary school gymnasium. And I went to.
So you're playing against elementary school students?
No, I'm not playing against elementary school students. I'm playing with my peers.
Your peers, but at an elementary school.
Other washed-up Jewish males.
I understand.
I'm pretty sure I'm on that list. Sean's on that list.
Yeah, you guys have played. Sean's played. So I made the mistake of eating an Illegal Curve sandwich Thursday at 6:30 when floor hockey was at 8 o'clock. And
let's just say, do you remember the Chris Farley in SNL when he was kind of wedged yeah. that chicken out of his chest?
During the bear sketch. Yeah, that was Ezzy. Okay, yeah.
So when I was about to play floor hockey, like I wanted to take a nap.
Naturally.
I heard you
had a hat trick though.
I did have a hat trick.
Okay, well there you go. So you were able to persevere through the pain of the digesting sandwich while you were playing an athletic event. Maybe there's a lesson here in future.
Well, that's what I was going to say to all those kids out there.
Yeah. You and Don Cherry talking to the kids.
If you're going to go get an Illegal Curve sandwich from Bernstein's Deli, make sure that you don't participate in any physical activity for at least 3 or 4 hours after you eat that sandwich.
It's like swimming after you eat.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good lesson, Ez. Thanks for looking out for the kids of Winnipeg.
Well, this is serious stuff. I mean, we take our deli meat very seriously on this show.
Very seriously.
And, you know, you have to make sure that you're taking the proper precautions after eating the Illegal Curve sandwich.
Patrick Laine, 3 goals on Wednesday night.
Has Patrick had a sandwich yet?
I don't know if Patrick's had a sandwich yet. My guess is, I would hope he's not, because that's probably not, you know, the right diet for a professional athlete, no disrespect.
Yeah, but you know, everybody has a cheat day, Drew.
That's true. Everybody does get a cheat. He had ice cream. What did he have? A bowl of ice cream with Smarties or something after, Dave?
That was correct.
That's correct.
Half a bowl.
Half a bowl of ice cream with Smarties afterwards.
His girlfriend had the other half.
Very nice. 4 goals.
Well, that's true love, isn't it?
Yeah. 4 goals for Patrick Laine in his first 4 games in the NHL. He's also got an assist. 5 points in his first four games. What are realistic expectations for Patrick Laine this season in terms of performance, in terms of goal totals? I mean, he's got 4 already. 3 of them came in that one game. He got the one in the part of the comeback against Carolina. You know, what is a number? Realistically, it's not going to be 76. So, what is a number of goals that you say that's a successful rookie season?
77.
77. Okay, he's got to beat Timu.
Well, it's Heritage Classic weekend. Oh, no. Well, I mean, you mentioned it, Drew. He's already got 4 goals here. He's obviously not going to score a hat trick every game, but you know, he might score a few more hat tricks. I wouldn't be surprised by the end of the season, you know, if he's around 40 goals. But I mean, look at. He's an unbelievable talent, guys. He's a generational talent. I think that's what's so exciting about where the NHL is right now with Connor McDavid, Austin Matthews, Patrick Laine. I would throw in a guy like Jack Eichel there. Even a Dylan Strome on the Coyotes is a very exciting player. I mean, look, these guys are all going to be superstars in the NHL, and we've heard this leading up to the draft, after the draft. But, Drew, look, at Patrick Laine scored a hat trick. Would anybody be surprised, you know, if he duplicates that again in the next couple of weeks here? I mean, the guy's got probably a top 5 shot in the NHL. The guy has dominated in the Finnish League. He's dominated at the World Hockey Championships. He's dominated at the World Junior Hockey Championships. I mean, this guy is going to score a lot of goals in the NHL. And if, you know, everybody is kind of obsessed with numbers, right? Everybody wants to get the numbers. So, I mean, is it unrealistic to say that, Dave, that he gets 35, 40 goals, 55, 65 points? I mean, that's probably on the high end, but certainly if Patrick Laine scores 20 goals and 40 points, that's probably a disappointment, isn't it?
You know, it's funny because we live in such an – I'll answer it in 1 second, but we live in such an instant gratification society that, you know, that first game against Carolina when he didn't have a hat trick.
That's why I have Timbits at every show, by the way, because I want to be gratified instantaneously by each Timbit.
Well, see, it's funny, but your actions don't speak true because when we get it at the drive-through window, you don't actually eat it until the show. So it's not instant gratification. It's
slightly delayed
slightly
gratification.
Delayed, which is funny. With Ezzy, everything's kind of slightly delayed, so yeah. That makes sense.
I like but being gratified.
but no, it's funny because, you know, when he didn't – and then the next two games against Minnesota and Boston, he didn't have any goals. So suddenly we're, like, panicking. Is it not – you know, is there something wrong with Patrick Laine? And then you see him – you know, explode for the three goals against Toronto, and you know what I mean. Look, I've seen him in practice. His practice shooting, as we've heard, is unbelievable.
Worth the price of admission, as they say.
It is. It really is. Like, if you actually watch this kid in practice, his shot is unbelievable, and it's like he does things with the puck. It really is. It's just you just kind of sit there and just. Not in awe, but you watch what he does, and you're just like, this kid is a wizard with the puck, with what he can do. The way he can shoot that puck is unparalleled for an 18-year-old right now. The kid is unbelievable. So I think, like, I don't want to put a points total because, I mean, right now I've got him projected at 82 goals because, you know, that's what he's on pace for. But it's hard to say. I mean, there's so many ebbs and flows. I did like him with Ehlers, though. I think Ehlers is so dynamic. And again, I think Ehlers is being lost in the conversation in his sophomore season. But I think Nikolaj Ehlers is such a dynamic player that he would just really be an interesting fit with a guy like Laine because he would set him up for a lot of shots. And that's what you need, right? Because if you think about it, Wheeler's a shooter, Scheifele's a shooter, Laine is a shooter, right? So, I mean, you kind of want a guy, do you want three shooters on one line versus an Nikolaj Ehlers who, as we saw in that game against Minnesota, has an unbelievable slap shot. He can shoot himself. But maybe he, you know, Ehlers with Perreault and Laine really works because then you got a really excellent facilitator with Matthew Perreault getting those two guys the puck.
I like Laine with Scheifele, by the way. And I think that, you know, Brian Little is an excellent playmaker as well. But I really like the ability of Mark Scheifele and Blake Wheeler, for that matter, who's one of the best setup guys in the league, to get Patrick Laine the puck. So I would expect Patrick Laine to play on all three lines and have a variety of teammates, guys. But Paul Maurice even said that after the first game of the season, or maybe it was before the first game of the season, talking about where Patrick Laine and Kyle Connor were going to play. Nothing is set in stone here. And if you look at a coach like Joel Quenneville, I don't know if you guys have been looking at what the Chicago Blackhawks
Brian
have been
Campbell
doing.
Played left wing last night for the Chicago Blackhawks.
There you go, Drew. And so Joel Quenneville.
You're
is
surprised they knew that, didn't you?
No,
aren't you?
No, I'm not. I know that you prepare 4 hours before every show, just like I do.
Yes, by curling.
Yes. Did you win?
We did.
Oh, you didn't, Drew.
No, we didn't, Drew. We actually won. We didn't lose or Drew. Yes, our team name, of course, is Win, Loser, Drew in curling.
So, for those of you who are not privy to that information,
yes,
one of the best names I've ever heard of
is Win, Loser, Drew. Yeah,
yeah, it's a great name.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, keep
the
going.
The only unfortunate part is that you're on the team, but yeah. No. But you're talking about Patrick Laine here, and we're talking about hard numbers and everything like that,
yeah.
Right? You know, 25 goals, 30 goals, 40 goals, whatever. The Jets know that Patrick Laine is going to struggle at times. And we already saw that in the preseason when he wasn't putting up any points, even though he was having scoring chances. Kyle Connor, Josh Morrissey, the coaching staff is well aware that these guys are going to have blips on the radar.
Well, we've seen it with every rookie that has sort of spent that first year in Winnipeg. I mean, Scheifele, you know, in his rookie season, started off well and then hit that rookie wall and then came back and finished strong. Ehlers last year, you know, started off well, hit that rookie wall in sort of November and December, and then from January on, he picked it up. So you're absolutely right that you do see it from every rookie that they sort of they start off fine for the most part, then there's a big adjustment period as the players, the opposition sort of figures them out, and then they have to change their game to sort of counter what the opposition is doing.
Right, Drew. And Patrick Laine is the first Winnipeg Jet 2.0 to come into the league as an 18-year-old.
Sure.
So the expectations are higher for Patrick Laine. The Jets know that he is a more talented player than any other player that they've ever had. And, you know, that's no offense to Mark Scheifele and Nikolaj Ehlers, who are already top players for the Jets. But Patrick Laine is just a cut above these players. So they know and they're willing to accept that he has games where he maybe isn't on the score sheet and he struggles. And, guys, Patrick Laine without the puck has struggled. If you watch him, I mean, he's tried to overplay the puck at times. Three goals doesn't completely erase the way he's played at times, but it kind of does in a way. Because if you win the game and he scores a hat trick, that's what the Jets want out of him, right?
Yeah.
The Jets didn't draft a two-way forward. I mean, the Jets don't want, you know, a John Madden type of player or a Jay Pandolfo. They drafted...
Had to name two devils, eh? That's, right. That's the only thing that came to mind are two devils.
Yeah, I mean, I could have used Stevie Yzerman or Sergei Fedorov.
Yeah,
but
they're a little bit more well-known than, say, you know, Jay Pandolfo or John Madden.
They formed a great third line for the Devils.
Uh-huh.
So,
about the Devils?
And they won cups. So, but Line A,
Stevie Yzerman and Sergei Fedorov, for the record.
So Line A, I mean, it's incredible, guys. What else can we say here? I mean, have we ever seen the MTS Center that loud? With the exception of maybe those two playoff games that we saw a couple of years ago, or maybe the first ever home game against the Montreal Canadiens 5 years ago, I don't think the MTS Center has been that lively and loud in a very long time. And it's amazing. It's incredible for the city. It's incredible for the franchise to have such a great talent. But, you know, I wouldn't get too fixated on the numbers. The guy's going to score goals. He's already got four. He's going to score many more. I mean, whether that's 40, 50, whatever, he's going to get his goals. And it's incredible. The Jets, I think, must be very happy that he has come out of the gate firing and he hasn't had any struggles.
I just think, like, it was just an unbelievable opportunity to be on a national stage with only one other NHL game being played. That was the Rangers and the Red Wings. And he, you know, I mean, again, and the MTS Center wasn't as lively as I expected it early on. And there were more.
They were down 4-0.
No. But I'm just saying, and it's interesting because I, you know, generally you can tell, you can differentiate. You know, in Boston, for example, there were a lot of Bruins fan. The Boston game, there were a lot of Bruins fans in the MTS Center. The Leafs fans, because I guess the color of the uniforms happened to blend in. But when the Leafs were scoring, there was quite a bit of cheering. So you know that kind of changed the dynamic a little bit. And then when Patrick Laine got his first goal, which was I think the Jets' second, of course, and then his third, and then of course the overtime. I mean, to score the overtime winner after Matthews hadn't scored. I mean, it's reminiscent of Eichel versus McDavid in, I think it was in Edmonton, where Eichel could have ended it in overtime, and then McDavid gets the game winner in their first ever matchup.
It's a bit of a movie.
Yeah,
I mean, it was a bit
of
a movie.
It really is. You couldn't ask for more poetic sort of first game between him and Matthews.
The Jets have been happy with the performance of Patrick Laine. The Jets' power play, on the other hand, has not been succeeding. We talk about that next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Near side, Ehlers. Ehlers backdoor score. Mark Scheifele on a terrific feed from Nikolaj Ehlers.
That's the puck movement the coaches are looking for. They talked about no dusting it off. Move that puck. Move it quick. Move it hard. And a good job off this unit. You have Scheifele who works the half wall. Little rotation. The motion they're looking for is Wheeler back to Buffalo, and he's going to roll up, comes to Ehlers. As Wheeler comes up, Scheifele goes off the back post. Just a great pass through that seam by Ehlers, and Scheifele, a good job just to direct that pass to Hammond and tie this game up at one.
That, of course, is Mark Scheifele scoring for the Winnipeg Jets on the power play. The only catches of it was, of course, in the preseason against the Ottawa Senators. Power play goals in the regular season have been few and far between for the Winnipeg Jets through four games, a grand total of 16 power play opportunities, of which they have only scored two goals, one of which came on a 6-on-4 situation. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, 25 minutes before the top of the hour here on TSN 1290. And this segment is brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the team at Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard. Give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. For more information or to make an appointment, visit Linden Market Dental Center. So, gents, the Jets' power play was the talk of the town during the preseason, but preseason performance is just that, meaningless. Since the start of the regular season, the Jets' power play struggles, as we have seen for the last number of years, have continued unabated. As I mentioned, 2 for 16 so far. 16 power play opportunities, 4 per game. That's not a bad average whatsoever, you know. If you can score on 1 out of every 4 power play opportunities, a 25% power play clip, you're going to be doing pretty well. You're going to be towards the top of the NHL. Unfortunately for the Jets, that hasn't been the case. As I mentioned, 2 for 16, One of those came in that 6-on-4 situation on Wednesday night when the Jets tied the game with the net empty. So really 1 for 15 in straight 5-on-4 power play situations. What's wrong with the Jets power play so far this season? And is this just a function of feeling each other out early on in the year, or is this going to be emblematic of how the entire season is going to go on the power play for the Jets?
Yeah, Drew, it's a very important question because the only certainty as far as the Winnipeg Jets power play goes is that it can't get any worse because the Jets had the worst power play in the entire NHL last year. So it's not personnel guys. Patrick Laine and Kyle Connor are two of the most talented rookies in the NHL right now, with the exception of maybe Austin Matthews and Dylan Strome and a few others. The Jets have the talent there.
Sure.
And I think they've always had the talent there. I think right now the Jets, and again, I'm not too worried right now because it's only four games and there are some concerns, but they have had opportunities. And let's talk about the power play, though, the makeup of the power play. The Jets like to go with four forwards.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been something that they've really started doing over the last couple of years, but they did it a little bit the year they went to the Stanley Cup playoffs. But when you look at the Jets' power play right now, I mean, Buff is obviously on the point, and you have Wheeler set up on the left side, the half boards. He likes to control it on his off wing. You know, we played the clip. Nikolai Ehlers is another guy that's played the point on the power play, that first power play unit. Brian Little's been a guy that when Andrew Ladd was here, Brian Little and Andrew Ladd were on the first power play unit. They've had Drew Stafford out at times. The Jets' power play formation is nothing special. I mean, most teams have a very similar power play setup, and we've talked about this on the show before. I think it was the first or second Jets year when we kind of went over the different power play setups. There's basically two common power play setups.
The umbrella setup where right. You have a guy like Dustin Byfuglien sort of at the blue line, halfway, you know, right in the middle of the blue line. Then you have three players lined up at the Ringeth line,
right,
or maybe a little bit lower down, one on the left boards, one in the middle, one on the right boards, and then you have a guy in front who's causing havoc. That's known as the umbrella power play setup.
Right, and when you're talking about the players that we just mentioned, especially on the first power play unit, you have a lot of guys that can facilitate the big shot from Byfuglien. At the end of the day, guys, the Jets are trying to do two things. They're trying to get something going down low, or they're trying to get it back to Big Buff for the shot with some traffic in front of the net.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, you mentioned the preseason, Drew, and it doesn't matter at this point, but I thought that the Jets power play was the most effective when they had Adam Lowry out there.
Well,
and everybody was, you know, laughing at me and saying that, oh, you know, Adam Lowry hasn't been very good.
We've seen situations this season so far where Lowry has been deployed on the power play really to play that role of the guy causing havoc in front.
Right.
The role that Dustin Byfuglien used to play on Chicago against
right.
Roberto Luongo all
but,
those years
but that's
ago.
That's important. I mean, you know, look at guys that have made a career out of scoring goals like that. Dave Andrechuk
sure.
was one of the best at it, but you look at the power play, and again, you know, the Jets, you know, might have a bottom 10 power play right now, but they're going to score goals. And Patrick Laine has been on the second power play unit. I wouldn't be surprised if he gets first power play time. Look, the Jets have a lot of talent, and maybe they throw out Tobias Enstrom instead of having four forwards on the power play, Drew, but I'm not too worried. It's early in the season. There are a lot of new line combinations happening. To me, it's not something that's necessarily a fundamental issue. It's just the Jets haven't got a lot of bounces on the power play. I mean, it's very rare that the Jets are going to have 6 or 7 power play opportunities like they did against Boston and not score. So I think that the personnel is there. They have to just move the puck a little bit quicker. I thought, especially in that Boston game, it was a little bit too predictable. The puck movement was a little bit slow at times. And you look at the really good power plays, there's constant movement happening.
Decisiveness. Because
right.
I think when you look at the Jets' power play, at least thus far, there have been instances where they're a little indecisive, where the puck stops. You know, it comes to a guy, and rather than either taking the shot or feeding it off to one of his line mates very quickly, he's a little bit on the indecisive. He's not sure if this is the... And I mean, and I get that you know, part of that it comes to do with new players, because you don't want to be... You know, you sort of, I think a lot of people have the general instinct that they might want to be a distributor as opposed to a guy who's shooting unnecessarily. You're not always 100% certain when the best time is to take that shot. And there is some gelling that still needs to be done. But, you know, so far through four games, it certainly leaves a lot to be desired on the Jets power play, Dave.
Paul Maurice touched on this. I don't remember exactly when. It was probably when we were talking about what he loses without having Brian Little in the lineup. And I think losing an experienced centerman, you know, who can win faceoffs in the offensive zone like Brian Little does, I think that really hurts your power play. You know, you look at the Jets last year, they were 30th overall at like 14.8%. This year right now, they moved up, as I said, they're bottom. Yeah, they are. They're 22nd, currently at a 12.5% clip, which obviously isn't very good, which is interesting because, you know, through the first five games of the preseason, they were at like 36%. Obviously unsustainable, but, you know, and they had, you know, they had Bufflin, they had Perreault on the point as well. They had Ehlers, Scheifele, and Wheeler as their power play one. Now, then they switched about a week and a half ago to Bufflin and Ehlers on the point with Stafford, Scheifele, and Wheeler. And now you've got, you know, like as he was talking about, having Lowry. And I will say, not necessarily for this year, but in the future, one player you Jets fans will 100% see in this in-front role will be Brendan Lemieux. Because I watched this kid in Moose practices, and he literally stands in front of the net, like will stand in front of the net for 10 minutes deflecting shots, screening the goalie or whatever it is. Even if there's no goalie in there, he stands in front and he just tips pucks into the net, from whether it's a slap shot or wrist shot, whatever. The kid, that's what he does, and he's got a lot of talent. So he'll be interesting for that role in years to come. But, you know, in terms of what they're going to have to do, I mean, the problem is, again, you're losing a huge player in Matthew Perreault, but as he says, this team has talent. So I think it's just emblematic of what we're seeing with this team overall, is just the whole team trying to kind of congeal and come together. And once that happens, once you see that kind of understanding of where people are, that, because we've got to remember, Wheeler, Ehlers, and Scheifele only came together last year, right? So it's not like this is a line that's been playing together for 4 or 5 years and has that chemistry of, or that deep bond. This is a team, that the line that's kind of formed, it's, you know, of recent note. And so I think, you know, you've got new players with a lot of talent, like Patrick Laine, Kyle Connor, Joel Armia. So, you know, you're putting those guys into the mix, and it's just going to take a little bit of time to kind of get used to, you know. And again, just going back to preseason, you can't use that because you're not playing against the best, right? Now, when you go put your power play against the best penalty kill, that's the difference of, you know, what you're seeing now versus what you saw in the preseason.
I think, Dave, the point is the Jets can't use personnel as an excuse. And sure, Patrick Laine is a newcomer to the power play. Kyle Connor is a newcomer to the power play. But when you're talking about Mark Scheifele, Blake Wheeler, Nikolai Ehlers, Dustin Bufflin, Tobias Enstrom, these guys have been on the power play for several years now. Ehlers is maybe one of the newbies to the power play, but all of these other players have been on the power play for years now. The Jets guys simply have to have a better power play. And the power, a good power play isn't going to make or break your season. Like, whether or not the Jets get in the playoffs is not going to depend on the power play or the penalty kill, but the special teams as a whole have to be better. If you combine the power play and the penalty kill, the Jets were, I think, second or third worst in the entire NHL. Sure. And that just has to be better. It just has to. They can't have a power play that struggles like this anymore. And, you know, Jamie Compon is one of the guys that's responsible for the power play, along with Paul Maurice and the guys that go out there and are put out on the power play. So it's got to be better. And I think it will. And it's only four games. If we're talking about this after 20 games, which we may be,
yeah.
But if we are, then I'm a lot more concerned. But I wouldn't be too concerned after four games.
Well, let's head to break. When we come back, we shift our focus to the alumni weekend, the Heritage Classic weekend. It's been a long time coming, but now it's here. We start talking about it next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Imagine, or I don't know if you can imagine, how excited we are to be back in this town or city of Winnipeg, where hockey is just not entertainment, it is part of life as well. It has been for me all my life. So I am so thrilled to be back here. It feels not like home, but almost.
Anders Hedberg and Alf Nielsen speaking to the media prior to their Hall of Fame induction ceremony on Wednesday evening at MTS Center. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com. Dave, you were there Wednesday night at MTS Center as part of the Hall of Fame induction ceremony. The Hotline officially inducted into the Winnipeg Jets Hall of Fame. Two-thirds of the members of the Hotline in attendance, of course. Anders Hedberg, Ulf Nielsen, Bobby Hull elected not to attend the ceremony. You know, let's start with the sort of the negative side of things first, and then we'll get into the positives about it. Did you get the impression, I mean, did you feel as though that Bobby Hull's absence, we don't need to rehash the politics and the scenarios and the situations behind his absence, but did you think that his absence sort of cast a pall a little bit over the situation, over the Hall of Fame induction, or did you think that the guys were saying, Bobby made his choice, that's his business, and we're going to embrace this opportunity?
You know what? Look, I think it's mixed. I think that, you know, there's definitely no question that I think people who aren't familiar with the ins and outs and maybe don't, you know, look at the minutiae as much as we do, or you know, maybe just hardcore diehard sports fans who read this stuff, live and breathe it, may not even know all of the backstory to that. So I think not having, you know, the whole line there maybe, you know, cast a pall over the ceremony. But I think that whatever was lacking from Hull's absence was made up by Nielsen and Hedberg, because they just embraced it. And, you know, Hedberg especially has such a – actually, they both have such infectious personalities, and they were both so happy. And it was clear. Like, it was clear to everyone how much they, you know, they loved the fact that they were – you know, or no, I shouldn't say loved, how much they appreciated that recognition from the organization, from the fans. I mean, you got to remember, a lot of these fans have no idea who these guys are. They just understand that these guys represent something. It's really an ideal. It's more than an actual, you know, oh, I can remember when he did this. Obviously, sure, there's a lot of people in the building who can remember when, you know, the Hotline was scoring goals at will in the WHA. But the fact of the matter is, many of these people just look at these guys as hockey heroes in the community of Winnipeg, and it's a tie to the history of hockey in the city.
That was their influence and their impact on the ice that led the city of Winnipeg to its greatest heights as a hockey city, winning all those Avco Cups, and that their performance, you can certainly argue that if Winnipeg wasn't the juggernaut that it was in the WHA, they never become an NHL franchise. It's the NHL sort of had to take the Winnipeg Jets because of how good the teams were. I mean, they kneecapped them as soon as they entered the league. But they had to take – you couldn't take – if you were taking teams from the World Hockey Association, the Jets had to be one of them because of just how good the teams were that played for the Jets out of the WHA era.
Well, that's just it. I mean, you know, fans might not realize that not all the teams made the transition into the NHL. There were only four teams that came over, right? So you have to appreciate, again, what these guys did. These guys put – I mean, obviously it was the signing of Hull, you know, at Portage in Maine, you know, that really put Winnipeg on the map and the WHA on the map, really, but as a serious competitor to the NHL. But there's no question that, you know, that line, their dominance, the four Avco Cups, I mean, if it wasn't for that, if not that, do we have, you know, NHL hockey in Winnipeg?
Yeah, it's unfortunate that Bobby Hull wasn't able to attend. But look, guys, we knew that Bobby Hull was not going to be in attendance, right?
Yeah.
So I don't think that there's any point in rehashing that. He's part of the Hotline, obviously, the biggest part of the Hotline. His number was retired by the Jets 1.0. But really, as Dave said, this is a celebration of not only that line, not only of the WHA and the NHL. It's really a celebration of hockey in Winnipeg. It's a celebration of Winnipeg, right? So, I mean, it was such an incredible sight to see Ulf Nielsen and Anders Hedberg come out to center ice and for their numbers to be up in the rafters as the first inductees into the new Jets Hall of Fame. It was really incredible. And, you know, they were at a couple of functions Thursday night, and they were at a function last night and Thursday afternoon. I mean, those guys are such classy individuals. And, you know, Dave mentioned some of the numbers that these guys put up in the WHA. It was really unparalleled. And they won the three Avco Cups, and those banners are now at MTS Center. They were just unveiled this season. So, I mean, it was such a special night. I mean, these guys mean so much to the city. We played the clip. I mean, these guys consider Winnipeg to be their second home.
Sure.
Right? So Bobby Hull doesn't get to come. It's unfortunate. There's nothing any of us can do about that, and we wish that he was here, and he was a big part of that. But I think it's lost in the fact that this has been such an incredible weekend. It's going to get even better, you know, once the games actually start here. The games haven't even started yet, Drew, sure. And it's been an incredible weekend. But, you know, I don't think anybody is going to focus on that. Well, I mean, people are focused on the positives, right, not the negatives.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned the weekend. I don't know that a lot of fans know that, you know, they know who's playing in the game, the alumni game this afternoon. But I don't know that a ton of fans know that there's a whole lot of additional Winnipeg Jets alumni who are in town. I mean, and even some Oilers alumni that are not going to be playing in the game, you know, this afternoon. But there's if you go onto the, you know, the Jets website and you go to the rosters or the attending alumni, there is a list that is so extensive of all these other Winnipeg Jets players that I hope, and I don't know, but I hope are going to be introduced today. They won't suit up and they won't skate during the game, but I hope that they're going to be introduced at some point in time and they're going to be acknowledged by the 30,000 plus that are in attendance at IG Field. Because it really is, I mean, it is a, you know, I tend to fall on the cynical side of things in general, but I'm having a hard time being tremendously cynical about it. Maybe a couple weeks ago I was a little more cynical, but, you know, I'm excited too, because these are the guys that we all grew up watching. Dave grew up watching the WHA Jets, but Ezzy and I were...
Drew, I, you know, I was going to make an age joke to you, but I'm like, you know, it's just too easy.
You're the old one in the room, Dave. Don't ever forget it.
That's true.
But anyways, it is going to be a very exciting opportunity to salute these players and salute these, you know, quote unquote hockey heroes that you know we remember from our youth. I mean, you know, I remember Brent Ashton. I mean, who knows where Brent Ashton's been for the last, you know, however many years? But he's one of the attending alumni at today's game.
Right, and there were only 22 spots available on Dale Hawerchuk's team. Right, so of the hundreds of players that have played for the Winnipeg Jets over the years, guys, mm-hmm. there were only going to be 22. So a lot of people wanted to see Keith Tkachuk, for example, or Alexei Zamenhof, or Freddie Olsen. But, you know, there's no point in really focusing on that. There's going to be an incredible game taking place this afternoon at Investors Group Field. And as you mentioned, there are a lot of Jets and Oilers alike that are going to be in town. And, you know, hopefully these guys do get acknowledged. Maybe they come out, you know, as a group, or maybe they just get acknowledged kind of on a, you know, case-by-case basis. But you're absolutely right, Drew. I mean, this is a celebration of all of these players. And, you know, when it comes to the Oilers, they might have won all of the Stanley Cups, but certainly the Jets did have a considerable amount of success. And, you know, they might have lost to the Oilers every single time they played them.
And but, we'll talk, you know, about that later on in the show, of course.
It's about all of the memories to me, right? And we could spend, you know, 5 hours talking about all the memories that we have of the Winnipeg Arena. You know, that includes after the Jets left, you know, the World Junior Hockey Championship in 1999 was one of my favorite ever hockey memories, you know, with Canada beating Kazakhstan. I think it was 12-2 in the preliminary round, and I believe Kazakhstan forgot their hockey equipment, and some local community centers had to donate equipment.
I don't know
to
that
them.
They forgot it. I don't even know if they could afford the sticks. There was a story, I remember that story, that I'm not sure that they had the funds necessary to have the necessary equipment available to them. And people, of course, in Winnipeg, given the charitable nature of the city and the charitable nature of most of the businesses in the city, rallied
right.
for that team of World Junior players from Kazakhstan.
Right. So, I mean, the Jets won those Avco Cups in that arena. Timo Solani broke Mike Bossy's record in that arena. Dave Ellett scored that double overtime goal in that arena. There are so many memories, and,
we'll talk
and that's
him.
What it's about, right? And so that's what's going to be incredible, to see everybody in various Jets jerseys just celebrating our great hockey history in the city.
Let me ask you, Dave. Sorry, in this
no, no,
room,
go ahead.
Let me ask you, who should be the next inductee into the Jets Hall of Fame?
In my mind, it's Dale Hawerchuk. I don't think it's even close. I mean, with all due respect, Timo Solani was given the key to the city yesterday. I think Hawerchuk is without a question. Because Timo, for all that we love Timo, and the fact that he was here for four seasons, and or parts of four seasons, and, you know, while he, you know, embraced the city and the city loved him, he was more an ideal. Dale Hawerchuk embodied the city of Winnipeg. He lived here. You know, he had a place in Gimli. He, like, you know,
still
he,
does.
Still, yeah, but yeah. I don't know if he still does, actually. But anyways, the point is that he really embraced living here. And he talks about it. Whenever you hear interviews with him, he talks about how it was that sense of community. He said, we didn't just live here during the season. We lived here all year round. He goes, not all, the whole team, but a number of teams. He was here for 9 seasons. His numbers are gaudy, and I'll talk about his numbers when we talk, pick our all-time Jets. But, like, there's no question in my mind. Dale Hawerchuk is the next guy.
Yeah, it's hard to agree with – pardon me. It's hard to disagree with that, Dave. I mean, Dale Hawerchuk's number was retired by the Coyotes organization, of course.
Yeah, that still didn't make any sense.
No, it didn't. But it's going to be Hawerchuk. I mean, I don't think anybody is going to be surprised. And there are other Jets that will be inducted. I think Teppo Numminen deserves to be inducted. I think Thomas Steen deserves to be inducted into the new Jets Hall of Fame. There are many guys that should be inducted. Teemu Selänne, we've talked about. So, yeah, I think it's got to be Hawerchuk. And I think it's a great initiative that True North has introduced, embracing, you know, the Jets 1.0 WHA legacy. It's really great. That was Wednesday night was a special night. You had the hotline being inducted into the Hall of Fame, and you had Patrick Laine scoring the hat trick. It was kind of like, you know, the passing of the torch, if you will.
And the one thing I will say that I do like is that they've changed all the banners to kind of blend with the colors within the arena. So now the arena is truly like a Winnipeg Jets. Because before, if you think about it, look, with the green seats and the green moose banners,
it still felt
like a moose building. Now you walk in, and it's funny, I'm still kind of, you know, we've been there for 6 years now, and you're still kind of caught off guard now because of this change with all blue seating, and, you know, the banners are now blue. And it's interesting because there are so many banners hanging. You know, we've got the three AFCO Cup banners. You've now got the hotline banners. You've still got, you know, they're still paying homage to the moose, where the moose, but they've just changed the colors to blend in. And it all blends in well within the building.
Joe Piscucci was a Winnipeg sportscaster for more than 30 years. He joins us next to talk about the alumni game and about the outdoor game weekend. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Hour number two of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew Mandel, Dave Minuke, Ezra Ginsberg with you. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website that's got all your Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live.
We are pleased to welcome to the program Joe Piscucci. Joe was a Winnipeg broadcaster from 1982, I believe, Joe, is when you first made your mark here in Winnipeg on the former CKND. We welcome you to the program, and thanks very much for joining us. Joe, are you there? We're going to work on getting Joe on air. We're not 100% sure what's happening right now. We've lost Joe.
Oh, there
Joe,
we go.
Can we hear? Yeah, can you hear us, Joe?
Yes, I can. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the program.
It is great to be with you guys this morning.
Yeah. Joe, we obviously brought you on. We're talking about sort of the heritage of hockey here in Winnipeg with the alumni game taking place later on this afternoon, and, you know, the outdoor game tomorrow, and really the celebration of hockey in the city of Winnipeg. You know, you were on the Winnipeg sports scene for so many years, you know, upwards of 30 years, a little more than 30 years. You know, do you have any sort of indelible memory or sort of, you know, that jumps out to you more than anything else about, you know, hockey in Winnipeg during your time here?
I guess it's the passion of the sports fans, really, and how, you know, the city lived and died with the Jets and the Blue Bombers, and how the emotions of the community, you know, you could tell whenever the Jets or Bombers won a game, you could tell the next day. And when they lost, you could feel it, you know. And even though, you know, you're supposed to be impartial as a member of the sports media, you know, that even though I wasn't on the ice in 1990, that hurt. That still hurts. As just someone who knows how much it would have meant to the community for the Jets to beat the Oilers in that 1990 playoff, it hurt.
You know, Joe, you mentioned the 1990 Dave Ellett double overtime goal, and I follow you on Twitter, and you've been posting your WHA NHL Jets heritage moments, and that was one of the moments that you posted. What was it like as a broadcaster to cover that game, and specifically that double overtime goal by Dave Ellett?
Well, for me, I was fortunate because I was in the south end of the arena in the press box, and my spot was right basically in line with the face-off circle, which was on the other side, was the far face-off circle. So I had a great view of it, and it was nerve-wracking. You know, again, you know, you feel as like you feel for the fans. I mean, I felt for those guys too, because I joined CKND, as you said, in 1982, And a lot of those Jet players, you know, were around my same age. So we kind of sort of grew up together. Howard Chuck, when I got here, Howard Chuck's first season. So you go through all those struggles against the Oilers. And that game was so nerve-wracking, especially when it got to overtime. And when Ellett scored, and if you read Randy Turner's great piece in the Winnipeg Free Press today about that, I mean, I was standing up at the time. And when he scored, and just the eruption of the crowd and just that wave of sound literally pushed me back a couple of steps. It was that loud.
You know, Joe, I figured nothing could be more nerve-wracking than walking out to the press box at the old Winnipeg Arena.
No, it wasn't actually that bad.
I don't know. That
it was better than being in the upper deck.
I don't know.
That was more of a steep climb.
I know. I hated that catwalk, though, but I just don't like heights. So Joe, Joe, I have a question for you. You know, you've covered – you're no longer covering the Jets, unfortunately, for us. But, you used to cover the Jets, you know, 1.0 and now the 2.0. What would you say that you noticed – have you noticed any differences in covering the team or in the fan base?
Well, I think that the fan base is a lot younger now. They're more, I think, in a sense, they're more supportive now than they were in some of the 1.0 days. Because, I mean, the average attendance during 1.0 was usually around 11, 12,000. You know, and I remember when I got to CKND and we used to broadcast the Jets games, you know, and we wouldn't release the schedule. You're only televising like 14 games. We had people calling us all the time wanting to know what the schedule was because they didn't want to buy tickets to a Jets game that was going to be broadcast on TV. That's the frugal Winnipeggers. But now that every game is televised and the building is, you know, what, 99.99% filled, it's great. The fans were fun. Covering the Jets, I mean, when I first started covering the Jets, you're not going to believe this, but the media were actually allowed to watch Jets practice from the Jets bench, you know, and so that's getting pretty close. And I remember
Joe, if we tried that now, they'd probably be firing pucks at us.
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I actually got the media banned from the Jets bench because I had done a story that Ferguson didn't like. So he banned all media from the Jets bench after that.
So you're the one to blame, Joe Piscucci.
Oh, I'm the one to blame. I mean, for those people watching, you know, the Heritage Classic, you're going to see, I'm sure Scott Oak's going to pull out the video from when Ferguson just tore a strip off him for a question because Fergie announcing about Barry Long becoming the Jets head coach. Right, and here's the art of asking a question. If you're going to be a smart aleck, my belief is you let the person know that you're going to ask a smart aleck question and you're just kidding when you ask them. So I asked Fergie if he had indeed fired himself by naming Barry Long as head coach because he took over after firing Tom Watt. Fergie answered the question. So then he goes to get interviewed by Scott Oak, and that is Scott Oak's first question. Without warning, he just comes up with, John, some people will say that you have indeed fired yourself. And John just lit up into him. Oh, with F-bombs everywhere. And at the end of the clip, and I'm sure Scott's going to play it, you're going to hear Fergie say, he just asked me the same effing thing, and that was me.
So you were glad to be out of the line of the fire and let Scott Oak take those bullets.
Oh, he took a big one that day.
Joe Piscucci is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Joe, of course, was a legendary Winnipeg broadcaster for over 30 years. I got to ask about John Ferguson because he was, you know, the ties between the Winnipeg Jets 1.0 and John Ferguson were just so immense, and the passion he had on his sleeve for the Winnipeg Jets. You know, what was it like interacting with John Ferguson on a day-to-day basis during those 1980s Jets teams?
You treaded softly. you really didn't want to get him mad because he was just as fiery as a general manager as he was as a player. And, you know, and I didn't want to get him mad. So if I was going to ask a sensitive question, I mean, I tried to, you know, lighten it as much as I could. you know, before asking him, because you really didn't want him to get mad at you, because he could just tear a strip off you. And he, you know, and it's just this fiery nature. But he was great to deal with. By the time I got there in 82, they had glassed up his spot in the press box, so he couldn't throw any more papers onto the ice. And everybody got upset. I think when they changed the clock at the old arena, it blocked his view of the Jets bench. So he couldn't see the Jets bench anymore. So the players, I know, were happy about that.
Joe, we all know that the go ahead.
Yeah, and Mo Mantha was telling me a story once. I think it was Mo, that they knew Fergie, they had played a bad period. They knew Fergie was going to come down, so they had actually put some kind of a garbage can in a spot just where he was going to walk in, and true enough, Fergie walked in and knocked it over, and so the players got a kick out of it.
Joe, the Oilers were the dominant team of the 1980s, winning the 5 Stanley Cups, and the Winnipeg Jets obviously never defeated the Edmonton Oilers and only got out of the first round once in Jets 1.0 history. What do you remember most about that rivalry, and do you think it's been lost a little bit, how good those Jets teams were, especially in the mid and late 80s with guys like Dale Hawerchuk and Thomas Steen and Paul McLean?
Okay, first, it was 2 times they got out because they beat Calgary twice.
Yeah.
All right, and you know what? The Jets just didn't have the goaltending. That was the major problem. They just didn't have the goaltending to keep up with the Oilers' firepower, because some games they would score 5-6 goals, but they would still lose. And that's, maybe I shouldn't put the blame entirely on the goaltending. They just didn't have the defense and the goaltending to compete. Grant Fuhr, even though sometimes he would give up 5 or 6 goals, would actually stop another 7 or 8. Point blank, great scoring opportunities. He would frustrate the Jets and the fans most times that the Oilers played. And the Oilers were so dominant. They were so offensively gifted. But, you know, the Jets could hold their own for a little while, but then ultimately, you know, the Oilers would take control. And that's why that 1990 series was so uplifting for the fans, because finally, you know, for the fans and for the players of the Jets who had gone through that whole 80s thing, this was their chance to come out on top. And then, you know, going up 3-1 and then losing the series on some questionable coaching decisions by Bob Murdoch, that was tough.
So, Joe, what do you have? Do you have any stories that, you know, I mean, this summer I wrote something called Weird Winnipeg, you know, stories from the past of the, you know, from the Jets. Do you have anything that's like an event that took place that would be unusual by today's standards?
Ooh, boy, I wish you'd give me warning on that.
See,
one.
I was thinking, actually, I should have texted you the way you would have messaged Ferguson, so I would at least have been able to warn you I was going to ask you that question.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's incredible how we were allowed, like, the dressing room access, right? I mean, we could go back into where the players were dressing. You know, they have their dressing room where they, and then they have another room where they go put on their street clothes, right?
Right.
And so we were allowed back there. I mean, I remember Don Whitman telling me a story from the WHA Jet days that they would actually, some of the members of the media, I wasn't part of the media then, but would actually, you know, be in the Jets hot tub on Saturday afternoons.
I can't imagine getting into a hot tub with Dustin Byfuglien, but okay.
Okay, but that was the I guess the relationship between the media and the players back in the 70s. I remember playing baseball. A lot of the Jet players stayed in Winnipeg during the summer, and they formed a baseball team. And I remember going out to Portage, La Prairie, and playing a celebrity softball game with the Winnipeg Jets. I remember Randy Carlyle yelling at me. He used to do that anyway, but he yelled at me in the Jets dressing room, and I asked a really easy question. They were in a playoff race with Calgary that they would ultimately lose, and they lost a game that was really close, and Randy had played particularly well. And so I go ask, and I always felt that, you know, if you're going to go after a loss, go to the player who played well, at least, you know. So I asked Randy, and I said, Randy, obviously that was a tough loss today for the team considering the situation. And he just ripped into me, you know, just yelling at me because, you know, of course it was a tough loss. Of course, what do you think? And but he came back about a minute later and apologized. But, you know, it's just the access that we had that I looking back, it was maybe too much access because we could actually be in the dressing room area before practice. And I think that was a little too intrusive. So I kind of, you know, as much as the media loves the access, sometimes, you know, it can get too close.
Joe Piscucci is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're talking about the Winnipeg Jets 1.0. Joe, back to 1985. If Jamie McCowan doesn't break Dale Hawerchuk's rib, does the second round series between the Jets and the Oilers turn out differently? I mean, the Jets were what? I think the fourth best team in the NHL that season entering the playoffs. They take care of the Flames to win their first NHL playoff series. And then McCowan breaks Hawerchuk's rib. Does that second round series turn out differently if Hawerchuk's healthy?
I think maybe the Oilers win in six instead of four straight. You know, there was only really, I think there was only really one game that was really lopsided from those from that four-game sweep. So I think the series come, you know, extends itself a little longer than four straight. But I think the Oilers would still come out on top because they just had too much firepower and too many great future Hall of Famers on that team that would to be denied. Can I play you something? I'm going to try something for you guys. Tell me if this works.
Okay.
Because we all talked about Dave Ellett's goal, but Dave Ellett had another part to play in another famous Jets goal.
I think Randy Carlisle breathed a sigh of relief when he got that puck back. He almost provided a great play on the team. Yeah,
so that, I don't know if you guys could hear that very well, but that was 1985 Brian Mullins overtime goal against Calgary.
That was the game one goal?
The game one goal in overtime, yeah, tipping the shot by Dave Ellett.
And it's sort of been lost in the sands of time, as everybody remembers Ellett's 1990 goal.
Exactly, yeah. So Mullen, who's going to be there today?
Yeah.
I mean, he was a fabulous hockey player for the Jets, and I think, you know, and they wanted, for some reason, the fans wanted him to play tougher, but he was a goal scorer. You know, he was not going to be a guy who was going to, you know, go into the corners and mix it up too much. He was a finisher, but he was a really good hockey player, and that line of Hawerchuk, McLean, and Mullen was really great for the Winnipeg Jets.
Joe, for someone who covered the Jets for so long, and with the two games coming up this weekend, what are you most looking forward to when it comes to the alumni game and then the actual game between the Jets and the Oilers on Sunday?
Well, I guess, like the player, just reliving some of the memories, some of those great Oiler-Jets battles that took place, you know, and Gretzky, I know that Gretzky's going to be on with Hawerchuk tonight. I wonder if they're going to bring up the playoff series where Hawerchuk took Gretzky down. But just some of the great battles that those two teams had and some of the great goals that were scored and some of the great hockey, you know, that we got to see. I can, watching the early part of this NHL season to the hockey of the 1980s. There's a lot more goals being scored this year. It's a lot more wide open, and it's just like the hockey was back in the 1980s with all the young players in the NHL at that time. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to living the memories, and then I'm looking forward tomorrow to seeing, you know, the future, you know, with Lion A and Connor McDavid, and that shot of Lion A is just incredible. You know, I think it's better than Tamo's. You know, Tamo could pick the corners, but I don't think he had as hard a shot as that.
Joe, we'll let you go on this last question. You sent us a tweet at Illegal Curve where you said, you know, identify this former Winnipeg Jet player. And it was a difficult one, and the answer turned out to be Lauren Stamler. So for our audience, who is Lauren Stamler?
Who is Lauren Stamler? All right, I knew you were going to ask me that. Lauren Stamler, according to HockeyDB, was born in Winnipeg, 1951, drafted by LA, the LA Kings, played for the Winnipeg for the Toronto Maple Leafs in 78-79, and then came to the Jets in that opening NHL season of 79-80, 62 games, 8 goals, 7 assists, 15 points, and a minus 29.
It was a bit of a tough year for the Jets that year.
So, yeah, it's kind of fun. It's funny. I never realized that Dan Bylsma was a Jets draft pick, you know. And so it's fun looking back at some of the guys that only maybe had a cup of coffee or never actually ever played for the Jets like Bylsma did, and finding out, you know, sort of the ties that bind a lot of the people in the NHL to the Winnipeg Jets.
Well, be careful not to go too far down that rabbit hole, because you could be spending an entire day or an entire week looking back at old Winnipeg Jets players. Joe Piscucci was...
It's fun, though.
It is fun. That's true. It is very fun. Yeah. Joe Piscucci is a Winnipeg broadcaster for over 30 years. He joins us to talk about the Winnipeg Jets 1.0. Joe, really appreciate your time and your memories. Thanks for joining us this morning on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
My pleasure, guys. Anytime.
Take care, Joe. Thanks very much. It's head to break. When we come back, much more on the Winnipeg Jets heritage. We look back more at 1.0. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290.
Puck in the Winnipeg zone. Huddy moves in from the point. Letts a shot. Oh, they score! Deflection. Ahead for Simpson. Simpson moving in. Scores! Makes the shot. Back to Ruotsalainen. To Tikkanen. Tikkanen looking for Curry. Curry shoots. Scores!
Lots and lots of goals by the Edmonton Oilers in playoff series against the Winnipeg Jets. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, 25 minutes past the top of the hour. This segment brought to you by Keener Jerseys. Keener Jerseys is known as one of the world's best jersey customizers. If you want awesome jerseys for your rec team or have a jersey you want personalized, visit Keener Jerseys online at keenerjerseys.com. Perhaps you have a brand new Winnipeg Jets jersey that you want personalized. Maybe you want it to say Ellett or Howerchuk or Slaney or, I don't know, Mullen. Or odd that you would put Mindell. I never played for the Jets 1.0.
Yeah, but you don't have to have a, you know, there's lots of people who have.
I was never a fan of putting your own name on the back of a jersey.
I would agree. I think it's a little unusual.
Yeah, I sort of find, yeah, all the backs of my jersey are actually just blank.
Yeah,
I never was a fan of putting somebody else's name on the back there. I was never a fan of putting my own name on the back of it there. But to each their own, and we do recommend that if you want to put a name on the back of your jersey, any jersey, if you need to buy some jerseys, you check out Keener Jerseys, located online at keenerjerseys.com, and of course their new location on the corner of Portage and Sherburn. We're talking Winnipeg Jets, we're talking Edmonton Oilers, we're talking about the history of these two teams, which are so intertwined throughout the 1980s. The numbers really are staggering. The Winnipeg Jets and the Edmonton Oilers met 6 times in the playoffs between 1983 and 1990. And the Oilers' record against the Winnipeg Jets in those 6 playoff series was 22 wins and 4 losses. I mean, we know that the Oilers were a juggernaut. And we know that the Jets had the grave misfortune of always being matched up against those Edmonton Oilers in the playoffs. But it really, truly is remarkable the level of dominance that the Edmonton Oilers had over the Winnipeg Jets. And I think it speaks less to, you know, a poor performance by the Jets 1.0, but more to a testament to just how good those Edmonton Oilers teams were throughout the 1980s.
Yeah, guys, and it was 1990. That probably was the year that the Jets were the closest to really beating the Oilers. No, it wasn't. They were up 3-1, and it certainly was the best chance that the Jets had to get past the Oilers. But, you know, nobody could get past the Oilers. So it wasn't just the Winnipeg Jets. I mean, it was the Calgary Flames. It was really every other team in the NHL. The Oilers were completely dominant in that 7 or 8 year stretch, right? So yeah, the Jets weren't very successful against the Oilers in the playoffs, but what's so special about that rivalry really was how underappreciated those Jets teams were. And we talked about it. I mean, Dale Howerchuk, if it wasn't for guys like Wayne Gretzky and Mario Lemieux, he would have won many scoring titles. So I mean, the games were certainly lopsided, but it's really about celebrating, you know, all of the good times that people had watching the Winnipeg Jets at that time. And, you know, you had Dale Howerchuk, who obviously came into the NHL and won Rookie of the Year in, I believe it was 1982, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, certainly we were pretty young in the mid-80s and the, even the early 90s there. But I was there in 1990 when the Jets beat the Oilers to go up 3-1, and I remember how loud it was in there. And it was certainly one of my favorite memories of Jets 1.0. So, I mean, it was just truly special to be really a hockey fan at that time, because sure. There's never going to be another Wayne Gretzky. There's never going to be a team like the Oilers. You're never going to have a team again, in my opinion, that wins 4 Stanley Cups in a row. I mean, we saw it with the Islanders, and we saw it with the Oilers, and we saw it with the Habs in the 1970s. They were completely dominant. But that team, the collection of guys, Gretzky, Messier, Curry, Coffey, we can go on and on, Anderson, Simpson, they were such a special team. So certainly, you know, it brings back some bad memories as far as how bad the Oilers used to thump the Jets.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you wanted to be beat by anybody, it was Gretzky's Oilers, right? So I'm sure that a lot of guys on the Jets alumni this afternoon are going to be playing for maybe a little bit more than some of the other alumni teams, because they're probably going to want to show Gretzky and the Oilers that they can beat them on their home ice.
Yeah, they can beat them on their own. I think that would be what a small salvation after all those losses during the playoffs when they were all playing in the NHL. But, you know, it really is remarkable. Just, I mean, it's how close Wayne Gretzky came to being a member of the Winnipeg Jets, as opposed to the Edmonton Oilers back in, you know, when he was sold from the Indianapolis Racers of the WHA. And you can't help but say what if and what if and what if, but you know, if the Jets had been able to avoid some of those Oilers teams with the divisional format that we currently see in the NHL, you know, the only years the Jets were able to get through the first round is when they were able to beat the Calgary Flames. I mean, you know, what if, you know, Jamie McCowan doesn't break Dale Hawerchuk's ribs? The Jets were the fourth best team in the NHL in 1985. There's so many different situations and scenarios that make you wonder if one thing had changed differently, if the Jets had been able to win a playoff series in 1990, if the Jets had been able to win a playoff series against the Canucks when they lost those back-to-back years in the Canucks in the early 90s, does the franchise maybe get the momentum to stay in the city so we don't have that gap without NHL hockey for the 15 or so years that was gone? It's just, you know, you can't help but play what if and think about the different scenarios throughout the course of the Winnipeg Jets.
True. I mean, but the reality is that you have to play with the team that you have. And sure, you were up against the Oilers. The Smythe division was not kind, right? Because like you just said, Drew, you know, once the Oilers' dominance, I mean, as just said, it wasn't four in a row, though. They won because Montreal won 1 year, but it was, I think they won 5 out of 7. But if you think about it, once the Oilers' dominance started to wane, you know, and you had obviously years where the Flames were really good.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had the Canucks. So, I mean, the fact is that the Jets, even when they were the team that they could, that was their Achilles heel, was finally, you know, gone. Then you still had other teams that they couldn't get past those.
Well, I mean, you're right. Those Canucks series, which really nobody ever talks about anymore, the Jets were up 3-1 against the Canucks.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that was just as heartbreaking, to be honest with you. Like, the Oilers one was more obviously because you couldn't beat that Oilers team, and it would have been so huge to finally get that win. But that Canucks one was a really hard series to get past. As a, when you're a young fan and you're sitting there going, like, you think, because you're thinking, you've got this. This is not, you know, this isn't the same as it used to be. This is a different kind of generation. And then the same thing happens, and you're thinking, is this ever going to happen?
Well, is this team cursed? You know,
right.
is you know,
can they only beat the Flames to get out of the first round, essentially?
Right.
Because that's obviously the only two teams they're the only team they beat twice to get
and
into.
And then
the
you look
round.
Back at the last year that they're in town, and they win that game against the Los Angeles Kings on home ice to qualify for the playoffs. Keith Tkachuk gets his 50th goal into the empty net, you know, so the Jets are playoff bound during their lame duck year, which is, you know, was astounding because nobody thought that they would even do that. And then all they need to do is they have that last game on the road in Anaheim. And if they beat the Anaheim Ducks, they get home ice advantage in that first round of the playoffs. Instead, they get blown out by the Ducks in a game where the Jets, I mean, wasn't a must win because they were already just in the playoffs. And instead of getting a much easier first round matchup, they end up having to face the juggernaut Detroit Red Wings, who, of course, beat the Jets in 6 games.
Although Nikolai Habibulin was insanely good in that series.
Game 5, of course, where, you know, it was after game
74 saves or something?
Well, it was game 4 where the Jets got blown out on home ice. The fans littered the ice with debris because everybody thought that was the last game that the Jets would play in Winnipeg because they were leaving, of course. Then he goes to Detroit, steals that game. Absolutely steals that game to come back for game 6, where, of course, the Jets, you know, fell, I think it was a 4-1 margin. 4-1 something. They were down 3-0 after 20 minutes. Not much I remember for sure. And that was the end of the Jets 1.0 at that point in time. It just makes you so many different scenarios throughout the course of the years where you could say, what if, what if, what if?
And as he's right, this team was unbelievable. I mean, if you look at some of the players that they had and some of the seasons that these guys had and just the chemistry that we, you know, we talk about this new Jets team trying to form a chemistry. I mean, if you saw the chemistry that these guys had, I mean, you're right. The sky was the limit. Unfortunately, ahead of them in that sky were the Edmonton Oilers. And they just couldn't get past it. They just couldn't get past that big oil
big oil drop.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Maybe they'll get a little bit of revenge as the alumni game goes later this afternoon.
I don't know. I looked at that Oilers alumni roster. It's pretty good.
It is pretty good. I mean, it'll be an interesting afternoon, certainly, at IG Field. And the game, of course, you can hear live on TSN 1290. Let's go to break. When we come back, we'll talk more about the Jets and the Oilers. Maybe we'll play some audio from yesterday and that the Jets alumni spoke to the media after their practice at MTS Center. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.